This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world. Occasionally.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Paul and Michael Occasionally Save the World. It's actually been a while since you and I have talked, Sparky. I looked at it, and the 12th was the last time, so it's been 17 days. It's been over 2 weeks since we've talked. Other people may not realize that because, you know, we've had episodes coming out every week, but we, I guess we got ahead of ourselves a little bit there.
Yeah,
okay. And now we finally have to record again.
Yeah, I enjoyed last week's your time with J.K. Woodward. I wish I'd seen the tweet about questions because I wasn't thinking that day and I didn't check till later and I was like, oh dang, because I could have given all kinds of questions, but it was a really, really good interview.
I tweeted right when we started. I completely didn't even think about it to the last second, so I didn't give anybody much of a chance, but it worked out because we only had limited time. I actually ended up keeping him probably 20 minutes longer than he intended to go.
Yeah, you seem to have that ability. Everybody says like 20 to 30 minutes and ends up being 50 to an hour. People forget time.
Yeah, a key for me is I when I'm talking to somebody like him, I want to make it fun for them.
Yeah.
You know, not just, you know, I mean, I don't want to make it just about, like, doing an interview about what they do or whatever. Like, I want to make, like, to me, when I hear somebody on a podcast, like, I want to get to know them a little bit. Like, I want to hear something more than just what new book are they doing. In that case, like, we weren't even doing that because he was doing a new book or anything. We just hadn't talked in a really long time.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of came about. But, just like when I did the podcast with Rafer, great to hear about Grumble, which that episode was about, but it's like, I want to hear more about, like, what other comics does Rafer like? He talked about his D&D stuff. Like, I don't even give a damn about D&D, but it was still fun to talk to him about that because it's what he's into and interested into. And, I think that's what really adds, the flavor and character when you're talking to somebody like that. You know, I mean, I like J.K. Woodward, he does great work, but I don't care much about Doctor Who or Star Trek.
Yeah.
I checked out those things because of him, but I mean, the only reason I even did that is because he was an awesome person that I got to know in the first place. It was really cool to be able to talk to him about Uncanny X-Men, and we could have kept going a long time. I had to get off for family stuff, and he probably would have regretted if I let us keep going because he still had work to do on his work. So
didn't he do an awesome drawing for you, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle themed one?
I actually have a few from him. The first one he did was a Krang commission that he did at the first convention that I ever went to, which is where I met him. It was dirt cheap too. Like, he does not charge enough for the work that he does. But that one was great, and then I saw him again the next year. He actually invited me to a convention he was doing down in New Hampshire, and I was able to go to it. And he did one for me that was mashing up Ninja Turtles and Valiant, because that was, you know, in the midst of my big-time Valiant fandom, which I'm sure you noticed us talk about Valiant fandom a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
He did, it was Raphael and Michelangelo, but, like, they were cosplaying as Archer and Armstrong, basically.
So
that was the second one I got from him.
Cool.
But the best one I got from him, my favorite thing, is he did one I'd been thinking of for a long time, and then it kind of worked out. It coincided with, in the Ninja Turtle storyline, Bebop and Rocksteady they beat Donatello to death, basically. Like, he almost died. They ended up doing crazy comic booky things to save him. But they broke his back. They broke his shell. And before that happened, I was going to have him do a commission because they'd done the Batman TMNT crossover. So I wanted a commission of Rocksteady breaking Batman's back, a la Bane in Nightfall. But then that happened. I was like, oh, this is even better because I could, like, I don't have to have Batman watering it down with mediocrity. I could just have Ninja Turtle greatness in it. So I did Rocksteady breaking Donatello's back. And
Yeah,
absolutely. I've seen loved that it. It one. Came out great.
That's a beautiful piece.
Oh, and he did a Hellboy for me also.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I've gotten a few from him. That one was pretty cool. He did a limited number of those for people who donated to, I think it was a GoFundMe for another comic creator. I forget the exact details, but fortunately I was able to contribute. I also got Rob Krieger, sorry Rob. I got Rob Krieger, like Seeger, to get involved too, and he got an awesome Green Goblin from JK. So
cool. Yeah, hopefully he'll be back on again with you, because I know
y'all
got a lot of music, and you barely touched on music. I know he has a lot of music information for him, it sounds like, so very cool.
Yeah, I was saying that we should just hook up and do a David Bowie episode sometime, so that's already in the works. At some point we'll do that. He's definitely a busy, busy guy, but I did actually talk to him a little bit before about how we decide what we devote our time to. And he had mentioned that, like, with him, he has his own podcast, like we mentioned at the end of the episode. And even though, like, he really doesn't have the time for it, it's his relief from everything.
Yeah,
it's kind of nice to know that when he has the time to fit it in, you know, it's something that's a positive for his day to be able to, you know, join me for something like that, do something a little bit different than what he does on his podcast. But
yeah, that's important.
Anyhow, wow, I got a bunch of tweets. That's surprising.
Uh-oh.
That's why some of them are on the account. We got a couple of Twitter questions here.
Okay.
I guess let's hit these real quick. We'll see if we get any more as we go. So we got two from Nick. First of all, and this is definitely your question to answer here. What's the best Texas barbecue?
Oh, God. What style of meat or where to get it? I've always heard, and the place I want to make a journey to someday is Franklin's, which is down in Austin, Texas. It's supposed to be the best, period. Dave had a buddy of his, Adam, on 2BT filling in one episode, and he had made the journey down with his wife, and they had to get up like at an ungodly hour, like at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to stand in line, because usually by about, I think, not much longer after noon, they're sold out of everything. There's literally a line that waits for hours. It's supposed to be that good. And I don't know if I could, that's something I don't know if I could do. A good brisket from anywhere that actually knows how to smoke a brisket is good, but one of my favorite personal things just to order is hot links. We recently found a place in a town near us that I'd never been to. It's called Texas Best Burgers and Barbecue, and it's this little crappy looking, not to disparage them, but it just doesn't look like, you know, you go to a lot of these food places and it just looks like they're usually a Western.
It's like a hole in the wall?
Yeah, it's just a hole in the wall, and they got the best hot links I've ever had. They've got the best smoked sausage, best brisket, best smoked chicken, and they charge next to nothing for it. From what I've had, the best barbecue I've ever had was a rib from a place called Cooper's in Fort Worth. So there's my answer for that. If you're ever down here, Nick, in the North Texas area, I'll take you to a little place in Wichita Falls. But if you're down in Fort Worth, hit up Cooper's. There's lots of other good places, so I don't know.
We got some replies to Nick's question also, but I'll get to that in a minute. So first of all, let me just say that everything you just said would literally kill me if I ate it.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I miss being able to eat barbecue.
It's so good.
His next question, I'll take the first crack at answering this next one, and then you can add your 2 cents.
Okay.
He asks, if I was to hit a Texas vacation spot, where would you recommend? My recommendation would be to skip Texas and go to Maine.
Yeah.
Because Maine's vacation. I've been to Texas. I don't really need to go there again.
You know.
But what would you recommend?
Oh, God. The first thought in my head was somewhere other than Texas, just because if you're coming, a lot of people travel in the summertime, and it can be brutal here. Yeah, I've grew up here, and it kills me some months. One of my favorite spots is just going down to the coast, There's lots of cool spots up and down the Texas coast. Of Houston, of course. I've never spent any time in Houston, but near there is Galveston. My wife and I found this cool place where you can camp out on the beach called Bolivar Peninsula. San Antonio's fun, but it's touristy. Austin's, a lot, depends on who you talk to. Austin is cool if you know where to go. They've got one of the best comic shops I've been to is in Austin. Can't remember the name right now, but it's really cool. It's one of those things. It's like my daughter. It's like whenever you live somewhere, you always want to be somewhere else. Like, she hates it here. And I remember growing up thinking, I just wish I could be somewhere else because it's boring. But then a lot of people come here and visit because of the history. And but if you came down, I'd definitely want to go visit the Alamo, something like that.
Yeah, that's kind of stuff that I'd like to do. See, I grew up where everybody wanted to go to get away from where they grew up. And I moved away, and I'm sure as hell glad to be gone. And I have no desire to go back.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I also grew up, I guess, adjacent to where everybody wants to go. But I grew up in the Mojave Desert, a little north of Los Angeles. And, you know, everybody thinks California is all great. There's a lot of California that's not great. Let me tell you that much. And the great parts are expensive.
California is big. Yeah, I visited California one time, and it's in Northern California near San Francisco. And it was in July. And it was my heaven, just from the temperature. But yeah, you can afford it.
Yeah, Northern California. See, I grew up in Southern California. Northern's a lot nicer in a lot of ways. I'm sure there's bad areas everywhere, but I grew up in the Antelope Valley, in the Mojave Desert. I mean, bad summer heats would be like 120 degrees. The trees where I grew up, they literally would have to plant trees with like two posts on either side tethered to the tree, and still every tree in the damn place leaned. The only good thing I could tell you about where I grew up that doesn't exist except one other place in the world is Joshua trees are awesome.
Okay. Yeah. Your desert.
Google a Joshua tree. Yeah. Chris replied to Chris Amundsen, who is in our Valiant Central Fantasy Football League. He replied, fast food style got to be Rudy's. Good God, I'll drop a paycheck there when on vacation. So that's his response to the Texas barbecue question. Next question from Nick. Movie breakdown time, which film is better? Which one has survived through the years the best? Roadhouse, Paris, Texas, which I actually don't know what that movie is, or 310 to Yuma. And with that, I question, does he mean the original 310 to Yuma or the remake with what's his name? So what would you say? Those three movies, which one would be your go-to?
Oh, God, I haven't watched any of those in a long time. Roadhouse, Paris, Texas, I have seen. And it's just I remember it just being a really well-done, thoughtful movie. Doesn't really fit to me with either of the other two. So I think it would probably stand the test of time. The most recent, 310 to Yuma, was a pretty decent movie. But, you know what, I'll go with Roadhouse just because it's this classic Swayze movie. I'll just go with that. But I do recommend Paris, Texas. Yeah,
I haven't seen Paris, Texas. I'll check that out. I'm going to go 310 to Yuma because it's just a good, solid, you know, Western, you know, outlaws and, you know, it's a good Western flick. Roadhouse I have seen, but that was well before my time. And
I haven't watched it.
It's
so
one of those
long
movies you definitely like better when you watched it when it was the appropriate time.
Yeah, yeah. I want to change my answer from Roadhouse back to Paris, Texas, because it might not. I haven't seen it in years, but I looked it up while we took a small break here. One of the reasons you probably never saw it is it wasn't a big release movie. It came out in 1984, and three things. One, it was co-written by Sam Shepard, who was a playwright, also an actor. You've probably seen him in a number of things. He's a good actor, but he's mostly known for his writing, and he's also wrote some short story collections that if you ever see him, pick him up. great writer. He died recently, I think, that last year or two, few years. That the main actor in the movie is Harry Dean Stanton, and the thing that immediately stood out to me when you brought it up, when Nick asked the question, was the soundtrack is by a guy named Ry Cooder, who is, he does film scores. He's a musician. He's a great, great guitarist, roots-based guitarist. And just for those things, I mean, I would like to watch the other movies, but if I had to pick one, it's not, that doesn't mean it stands a test of time, but that's the one I would pick if I could go watch it tonight. So I'm changing it, Nick. My answer is Paris, Texas.
The thing that stands out to me the most about Roadhouse is the Family Guy episode where Peter Griffin's talking about watching Roadhouse, and every time he does something throughout the episode, he just goes, Roadhouse.
Yeah.
And I've seen Roadhouse. That's still the best thing of Roadhouse is that Family Guy. So next question from Nick. This is definitely for you. How important is Walker, Texas Ranger?
I could care less. That's my answer. I don't care. I grew up watching it's so unimportant I can't remember the guy's name right now.
Chuck Norris.
Yeah, I love the Chuck Norris memes about how tough he is. When I was a kid, I liked his action movies. I liked the fact that he fought Bruce Lee in a movie early on, but I could care less about that show. So don't waste your time.
My knowledge of Walker, Texas Ranger is commercials coming on the USA Network when I was watching WWF back in the day when I was a kid. All right, next question. Now we're getting some from Chris Edmondson, who's in our fantasy football league. His first one, who's the next up-and-coming tight end to rival the stats of Gronk? Do we have one in the NFL yet or college? College football, I know nothing about. I don't watch college football. I don't care about college football. I don't care about any colleges. I got no allegiances, whatever. I always think it's funny, a little tangent on that. I always hear people say how great college sports are for various reasons. Literally, every time I try to watch college sports, I just think this is awful. These guys don't know how to play this game very well. Because obviously they're way better than I would ever be. And there's some very talented people in there playing. But man, I'll watch college basketball. Yeah. You know, March Madness is on. It'll be getting towards the end of the tournament, and I watch them suck it up and down the court. I'm like, what the hell is going on? Yeah, I mean, granted, pro basketball, that happens sometimes too. But I don't know. Like, I definitely, I have my pro team allegiances. Everybody has their driving factors why they like different things. But this whole, purity of college sports, yeah, whatever. I don't buy that.
I can't.
As far as next up-and-coming tight ends, I don't think there's anybody on the landscape that's going to rival what Gronk can do at his best. I think that there are some interesting guys playing right now, talent-wise. But, I mean, Gronk, if I remember correctly, Gronk was doing it as soon as he came in the league. He was making a big impact. I don't think it took him some time developing or anything. I don't remember what his breakout season was, but I feel like it might have been his rookie season. I'm not sure. I don't think there's anybody right now that's going to compare with that. I think the up-and-coming guys I think the tight end position is changing somewhat to allow for some – I think that we're going to see more potentially impactful tight ends with how the position is changing with the success of some players like Zach Ertz and Gronk and Kelsey. They've been a big deal for their team. They're just kind of a different type of receiver that has different abilities compared to, your typical wide receiver. The biggest thing is they're big, strong guys, but they got to have the hands, and you don't, that's you always say why does a guy play on defense, like a cornerback or somebody? Because they don't have the hands to catch the ball. Otherwise, they'd be a wide receiver.
Yeah.
you know, tight ends, they're not just blockers like back in the day, but they got to be able to catch the ball. Like, I think if you have a tight end who's going to be impactful, like, you throw the ball their way, they have to catch it. And that's the big difference. Like, a lot of the guys you see with potential drop the ball too much, and that's why they can't break that threshold and become the next big deal. But do you have anybody you'd like to add to the tight end conversation?
No. I'm pretty sure they're not on my fantasy team now. The way things are going, if they are, they need to really start doing it. But no, I really can't give any input on that.
Yeah, I mean, the guys I would say right now, Evan Ingram, who I stumbled upon last year, almost dropped, and Garrett, who's in our league, actually made a comment that made me hold on to him. He's been really good. David Njoku, who this is his second year, he's playing on the Browns. He's looking like he has the potential to break out. George Kittle on the 49ers, but then they just lost Jimmy Garoppolo, so we'll see how that goes. Did you see the highlight of the Monday Night Football game? Vance McDonald on the Steelers stiff-arming Chris Conte into oblivion?
No, I didn't.
Oh, it's a thing of beauty. Vance McDonald played for the 49ers and was traded to the Steelers a season or two ago, so I got a soft spot for him. You should find that clip and watch it. It is a hell of a stiff arm.
Yeah, I'll look that up.
Moving on, it's his next question, which I haven't read. I haven't read ahead anymore, so these are all new to me as I'm reading. You're a defensive coordinator. You're playing the Pittsburgh Steelers at their current state with Juju playing like he is. Who do you double? What defense works best? So he's saying, who do you double? Do you double Juju or do you double Antonio Brown? I think the answer to that is you double Antonio Brown, and that's why Juju is doing what he's doing. Juju's very good, but Antonio Brown is something special. What defense works best? I don't know enough about different defensive schemes to be able to say what type of defense works best, but I think when you play the Steelers, I mean, they got two great receivers. Right now with them, well, I mean, even their running back, even without Le'Veon Bell, their running back has been pretty darn good. Plus, they make other guys good. I think really the way that you get to the Steelers isn't by shutting down Roethlisberger's outlets. It's by shutting down Roethlisberger. That's the same way the Giants beat the Patriots twice in the Super Bowl, is they got to Brady, so he couldn't do his thing. And Roethlisberger, he's you know, he's getting to towards the end of his career. He's a lot more easy to fluster. But the thing is, if you try to go all out on a Roethlisberger and you fail, he will make you pay for it too. He's got a lot of skill. I hate to say that because I really don't like Ben Roethlisberger. I think he's a total douchebag. So, moving on. Okay, now back to comic book questions. Now that we lost all our listeners. Once again, I haven't read these yet, so this is my first read of these. Black Label is supposed to be adult-themed, yet they yanked the wang out of Batman the Damned. Do you feel DC regressed by not keeping Lil Wayne in the comic? With the hoopla, do you even care about Black Label now? That is actually an interesting question. I have a feeling... I don't know what Martin's talked about on Comic Talk today, but I have a feeling Martin either has addressed this or will address this and probably do a better job than you and I could do with this. But I actually have a lot of thoughts on this subject. I'm assuming you've heard about this, but do you have any strong opinions yet?
I don't have an opinion because I've heard of it. I have not, haven't read any of it, so I can't really comment.
I haven't read it. I have seen pictures. So one thing I see a lot of people say, why is it a big deal? You're showing Batman's penis, okay? It's a big deal because he's Batman. You know, I mean, of course he's a fictional character, but he's a very, like, he's a celebrity of fictional characters. You know, I mean, he's a big deal character. If you show big characters that have never been shown nude, it's going to catch some attention. I mean, it's just like... Halle Berry was never nude in a movie for the longest time. Then all of a sudden, when she started being nude in movies, it was a bit like, you knew about it. Everybody knew about it, because nobody had ever seen Halle Berry's boobs in a movie, and then she started showing them in movies. The movie Swordfish was the first one where she ever showed her boobs. That literally was like the highlight of that whole movie, was Halle Berry's boobs were in it, you know? You can't act like it's not a big deal. look at other comic book characters. If they had, I don't know, I've of course been obsessed with the X-Men lately. So if they had Rogue's boobs in an issue of the X-Men, you know, Marvel Knights comes out, so they're edgy, and they're allowing them to do it. I have no idea what they're doing, Marvel Knights, by the way. But, you know, they're allowing, they have this little niche that's allowing those envelopes to be pushed. If they had a female character that has never been nude, but is a very well-known character, and they had her nude, it would be a very big deal. And there would be a lot of people probably outraged about it. This is just like a bunch of hullabaloo because some people are excited to see Batman's penis. Other people think it's funny. Other people yeah. are worried about the children. Whatever. There's plenty of Batman books that are way too dark for kids to read, way too full of violence and awful stuff. So I think that trying to say, what about the kids, because Batman's penis is in a book that's clearly stated as not for children, is pretty ridiculous. I think pretending like it shouldn't be a big deal is ridiculous. I don't know if the artist's intention of drawing Batman's penis in the book was to draw the attention that it would draw. But you know DC's intention was to draw the attention that it drew. The one thing that I think is kind of funny is, I guess, and I could be wrong on this because this is all just reacting to what I've seen other people say, but I guess they've edited it out. So, like, if you go to get it digitally, I'm assuming, it's not there. I'm assuming on the reprints, they've edited it out. Okay. That's going to make the value of those unedited books very valuable. I think that's where it's like, well, why'd you do that? If you did it in the first place, just let it be. I don't know. I think it's all kind of a funny situation. Honestly, like, I didn't have any particular interest in the Black Label, like, positively or negatively. And this doesn't really change any of that. I didn't run out and get this book. You know, like, I kind of wish I did now so I could sell it and make money, but I didn't care about the hoopla. And, you know, the story content will be there in the future when I feel like getting around to it, if I hear that it's a good story. I haven't heard a thing about the quality of the book.
I haven't either. I'll take back a little bit of what I said earlier. I did see an article about it, and I clicked on the article, and I was reading about it, and then they showed a picture, and I'm like, I didn't see what the big deal was, because all I saw was his legs and body, and then he's like kind of like his lower midsection was in shadow. That must be the censored version, I guess. So you're actually saying they actually just went all the way out there and just like, here you go.
Yep, yeah, his ding-dong's right there.
Okay. Well,
Lil Wayne is my favorite nickname for it, by the way. Definitely my favorite nickname for it.
Yeah, I don't. That's what threw me off, because I wasn't, what the heck is he talking about? But now, I know about this. I don't care. It's not something I don't really see why they would feel the need to include it in there. But I guess they're trying to be edgier. And hey, a lot of people are hearing about it, so a lot of people are probably going out and buying the issue just because of it. So it's maybe as a marketing deal. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I saw a lot of comic artists respond too, just with like, the human body is beautiful. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, there's always a decision to include anything that you're going to include. But obviously with Black Label, they erased these boundaries that would be there in, like, DC proper books. So, I don't know. Like, I don't care if they include it. Like, I've read plenty of comics where I don't care if there's nudity or not, you know, and I've seen all kinds of nudity in comics. I've seen some where it's had nudity that I have not liked being in there. A book that you and I have talked about offline before is Tokyo Ghost. In that book, the nudity in the book definitely derailed the book for me. There's other books that have had penises and whatever else that it doesn't matter because, like, it feels more natural in the context of what's being shown. Not something that's excessive, you know? So, whatever. I think it's all kind of silly, but I think reactions on both sides are silly. Like, to react and say that nobody should care is as ridiculous as the reactions that are freaking out about it. So, I don't know.
Right, yeah.
The penis definitely didn't sell me on the book. I didn't go out and buy it. So.
Same here.
Well, these Twitter questions have ended up taking a while. This is the last one that we've gotten, unless any more pop up as we're going. Another one from Nick. Which comic character needs a makeover more? And he gives a list here. So I'll let you go first. I'll read through the list, and then I'll shoot out my thought. Scarlet Spider, Red Wolf, Blob, Texas Twister, Phantom Rider, or Forge from the X-Men?
Jeez. Nick's knowledge is so deep, so much more broad than mine when it comes to this. I've recognized several of those names. I'd like to see Texas Twister, for obviously, because I'm in Texas. And I actually have read a little bit about him. I haven't read any comics with Texas Twister in it, but I think that'd be cool. So that's my vote.
Yeah, Blob and Forge are both characters that I really don't care much for their character design. Like, Blob is just too much of a... He feels like the giant from the Mickey and the Beanstalk cartoon. Like, he's just big and doofy looking. Like, I don't know. Like, he could be more interesting, I think. I was either read or listened to a podcast talking about how just lazy of a character he was, too. It's like, he's really heavy, you know? I mean, he's a silly character in some ways, but anyways, Forge is... I've read Forge more recently. Where I'm at in my reading of Uncanny X-Men is Storm just lost her powers, and Forge is heavily involved around that time. As far as I know, that's the origin of Forge. He may have originated somewhere else, but I don't think he originated in X-Men before that point. I'm reading basically around where his character design. He has a horrible mustache. It's the 80s, so like everything really screams 80s. I don't know exactly how his character has been portrayed more recently, but that character design back then, like if he's going to be used again, like he should definitely be updated.
Yeah.
And that is Twitter questions. We went a lot longer on that than I expected. It's a good thing we got started early tonight.
Heck yeah. It's a good thing I don't have anybody in my house right now, so I can go on for a little while. Actually, it's been a day where my wife and daughter and Delilah's at grandma's, so they left to go to something with my sister-in-law and niece, and I've been home all day by myself, and it's so weird because I'm never alone. It's such an odd feeling. You know, I'm like reading comics and stuff, and I'm like, this is not normal. There's something very not normal with this.
I know what you mean. Then you start to, even though you finally have the peace and quiet that you never get, you start to feel like something's wrong because you have all that peace and quiet.
Yeah, it's like something's wrong. Something is wrong because there's no noise, there's no one talking, there's no one doing something. Yeah. But it's understandable because if they were here, my house would probably be chaos. So I wouldn't be able to do this. Maybe.
That works out. Alright. Alright, so now that we've answered all the Twitter questions that we have, at least for the moment, looks like we might get some more. We'll see. Just some likes. Okay. We'll see if we get any more Twitter questions. But we went for a while on that. Those are some fun ones to talk about. Let's get on to some of our selected topics at hand. So I'm going to start. You may know. I know you know because I tweeted you a picture of the comic book, but the return of Wolverine just happened. So Wolverine proper is now back in the Marvel universe, and I don't even know if I knew this was coming out, but I saw it in my comic shop, and I asked my shop owner about it, and he liked it, and I'm a fan of Wolverine, and I had actually read The Death of Wolverine at some point before on Comixology Unlimited. Or I'm sorry, not comic, Marvel Unlimited, I had read it a while back, and I enjoyed it. I like Wolverine. And you know what? Old Man Logan's cool and all, but I just want some good old Wolverine, you know? I even read the all-new Wolverine with X-23 as Wolverine, and that was good, too. But I just want some Wolverine. So I was excited about this, and before I read it, I thought, you know what? I really want to get in the flow of the story. So I Googled around to find out what I needed to read to really be ready for the return of Wolverine. And it said that this story started with the Volume 5 series, which is the 2013 Wolverine series. It continues into Volume 6 and then The Death of Wolverine. And then there's like 7,000 spinoffs of that, of course, because this is Marvel we're talking about. So between Volume 5, Volume 6, and The Death of Wolverine, I believe that was like 32 issues, because one of them was... maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was like 30. One of them was, I think, 14 or 16 issues. One of them was 12, and then The Death of Wolverine was 4 issues. So, however all that adds up. So I read Volume 5. I read Volume 6. Both of those are written by Paul Cornell. The art on Volume 5 is by Alan Davis, and Volume 6, the art, is by Ryan Stegman. I was also excited about that because Ryan Stegman does the art for Venom, and I've really been enjoying the art in Venom. So reading these, they're totally readable comics, but the fact that I read all of that in 3 days... Mm-hmm. Also kind of says a little something about the comics. These two series drove me nuts. Like, I did not, especially in the context of Wolverine, I did not care for the stories very much. It really just seemed like putting out Wolverine stories. It really bothers me that something so huge as Wolverine dying and then Wolverine coming back to life spawned from how weak I thought these titles were. Like, I really thought they were weak. I still enjoyed reading them. Don't get me wrong. I still enjoyed reading them.
Yeah.
But they were nothing to speak of. Like, if this didn't lead up to Death of Wolverine, there's no way I ever would have read these. So you had, I texted you a picture of the Return of Wolverine and told you I was going to send it to you, and you asked if I should keep it, because, you know, Wolverine's my guy.
Yeah.
And these two series are a good example of why I don't feel like I need to keep it, because I have no desire to collect these two series. Now, who knows? Maybe years down the road, I start collecting, like, the first volume of Wolverine, I get really deep into that, and then it goes from there, and then, you know, before you know it, I just keep going, and I collect these, so I have the whole run. Maybe. That's a long shot. It's a long shot that I go that deep into anything. But, yeah, it's just like there's like nothing special about them. The art was fine in both of them, but nothing special. Even the Ryan Stegman art, like, I did not think it was as good as how he does Venom. It was still good, but I definitely I think Venom suits his art style a lot, and I don't think everything suits it the same way. Not that it was bad, but it wasn't special like I feel it is in Venom. Like, in Venom, I think it really, like, that's what drew me into Venom, really, was, like, the art just was special in Venom to me. Like, it was a lot of fun, like, really drew me in. But basically, like, the whole story that leads up to Wolverine dying, he loses his healing factor because of some BS about some, like, sentient virus from an alternate dimension, basically. It's like, how, you know, Marvel BS is that? Like, come on. Yeah. Like, it seemed like such a throwaway story that they just kept on running with. That's really, really what it seems like. You know, and then you have all these showdowns, you know, he's kind of learning to cope with it. There were some cool moments. Like, one of the things I thought was cool is this was around the time that Superior Spider-Man was going on. So, you know, Doc Ock is Spider-Man, which, like, that's a fun series. It's definitely some Marvel PS right there. But,
yeah.
You know, like, that's a series of craziness that, like, people look to as being something that at least was kind of fun and different. But he makes Wolverine armor because he doesn't have a healing factor anymore. So Wolverine's whole attack style has always been, like, it's just pain. He could deal with pain, but nothing's going to kill him. So he just goes in and takes all the hits. So he has to adapt. But yeah, like, through all this, I mean, there's some better moments and some weaker moments. Another aspect that I really, really dislike, he's working in ways with, like, with S.H.I.E.L.D. and stuff in this. And there's one part where he's in the car with Jubilee, who's a vampire for some reason. I'm not even ready to grasp all that, but he's in a car with Jubilee, and then he gets this transmission going straight into his head from Maria Hill, who's in the alley across the way, and she says, I'm sending you this transmission through blah blah blah. It just, to me, was like such a lazy-ass way to say, let's get this character from point A to point B. Literally, just, I'm telling you this with some really ridiculous made-up technology that I'm having to explain to you what it is because we can't even portray this in a comic book. Awful. That was like one of the most awful moments that I've read in like, it was just so lazy, so cop-out, and just disappointing. So that's a big chunk of what I've been reading, is I read that. Death of Wolverine, I really like. And then the Return of Wolverine, it's the same writer and artist. I don't know about the rest of the creative team. But, of course, I don't have this handy. Where is it? There we go. Okay. Let's pull up the picture I sent you. So Charles Soule is the writer. I like Charles Soule.
Right. He did Daredevil, right?
Yeah, he did a good run on Daredevil. And to me, like, seeing Paul Cornell's writing on Wolverine up to the Death of Wolverine, and then seeing Charles Soule's writing, like, it really makes Charles Soule's writing just look like poetry. It just looks fantastic compared especially. But, like, it really, really just illustrated to me the difference between status quo comic book writing and something that's better than that. Charles Soule, I think, is something. You can have great writers write a book and do a half-assed job, too. That happens sometimes. Sometimes they're just, it's their job, you know, and they're doing what they're doing. But, like, when you get a creator who is really good at what they're doing, it just, like, is so drastically better. So, you know, The Death of Wolverine, which that read really quick, too. There really wasn't a ton of substance to that four-issue series. Like, it feels like it gets to the point real quick. But just, like, night and day different. I believe it's Steve McNiven, if I remember correctly. Because it just shows his last name on the picture I'm looking at. His art really works for Wolverine. Like, it's good art. Like, the other art was good, too. But, like, Steve McNiven's art really works for Wolverine. So, really enjoyable. They do both series. Obviously, only the first issue of Return of Wolverine is out thus far. But I look forward to reading the rest of it. And you'll get to read it, too, most likely. Because I'll just send it on to you after I read it. So.
I look forward to checking it out. Yeah.
Said.
Do you think... What do you feel about when they kill off a character like that and then bring him back?
In Marvel and DC, it's going to happen. I mean, like, you really...
Yeah.
It can still be done well, and then I think that they got to keep the character away for a while, so there's still the sting of the character being dead. When I first started really heavily reading comics and reading Marvel, reading the stuff that built up to Avengers versus X-Men... is what really got me into Marvel. Because I started reading... Like, I went to a comic shop and I was like, I want to read X-Men, but there's, like, way too many X-Men books. I don't know what to read. None of them are, like, this is the book. And that was at the time, it was right after Schism, where Uncanny X-Men was, like, Cyclops' team, and Wolverine and the X-Men was Wolverine's team in the school. So they said both of those. So I got both of those. And... this was at the time leading up to Avengers versus X-Men, and they had one of those like little free giveaways that tells you read all this stuff that, you know, leads up to it. And so I was going to Bull Moose and getting used trades of all this, Messiah Complex and just like all this different stuff that was leading up to Avengers versus X-Men, building up the character of Hope and all this stuff. And in the midst of all that, I couldn't tell you exactly which book it happened in at this point, because I just read so much that it's just like muddled together now. Nightcrawler dies. He's been brought back at this point. But Nightcrawler, who is probably my favorite X-Men. Like, Nightcrawler, Wolverine, Storm, all three of them are up there for different reasons. But I think Nightcrawler might be my favorite. And then I'll talk myself out of it to one of the other ones at another time. And to save Hope, he teleports himself to where, like, when he reforms, he saves Hope from whatever was going to kill her, but kills himself to do it because he Bamps himself into the midst of this thing. And like, I remember reading that just like really being like, I felt the impact of it, and it was still years later. So like, even though I was reading backwards a chunk of time when I read that, it was years later before they brought Nightcrawler back. So there was a good chunk of time before they brought Nightcrawler back where he was just dead. You know, I mean, with Wolverine, same thing. Death of Wolverine, it's been a while since that happened. And they've had X-23 as Wolverine. They've had Old Man Logan, where it's, you know, the same character, basically, but, you know, not exactly. But just like I said, there's nothing like just the Wolverine that we know being back, you know? So I think that, you know, if you do it right, it's fine to do that stuff, but you also kind of expect it, you know? And in other comics, you can't just do that because it's different, you know? I mean, Big Two is like, you know, like Simpsons episodes where by the end of the episode, everything is back to normal. Nothing carries over. There's been very few things in the whole run of The Simpsons that have ever carried over permanently. And any of those big ones, like, do you really care that Ned's wife died?
No.
Yeah, exactly.
No.
So that's kind of my thought on it. Like, you know, whatever. It's comics. DC and Marvel have been running a long, long time. They can't kill off major characters and never bring them back. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I see that. It's one of those things. It's like you kind of got to take a pause to kind of take a new look at the thing. But they don't have to kill them to do that. They can think of another way about doing it. But yeah, I get it. But do you think, Soul, his the issue you read, you're happy with it though?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right, so let me get into last time we got together and talked, which was, 17 days ago, you said, at the beginning of the show. I'd brought up Sword Daughter, right, by Brian Wood.
Sounds familiar.
With Mac Chater, I think that's how you say it, doing the pencils and colors by Jose Villarubia. And I don't know if you'd read it. At that point, you hadn't read it when I brought it up, but you had bought the first issue or two.
Yeah, I bought the first two issues on the Comixology sale for a buck a piece.
Yeah. And what was your take on that?
So, you were really excited about it. I'd heard about it from other people. Hearing the premise sounded interesting enough to me. The word samurai was bandied about. It's not a comic book about samurai, per se. But there is samurai philosophy in the characters, I guess you'd say. So I start reading the first one, and it was good, but especially the art is good. But my one thing with the art is that all the action stuff looks like you posed characters for the action. Took a picture of this non-moving pose and then threw some crap on there to make it look like there's action. Like, there is no sense of movement other than, like,
yeah,
here's these characters standing still in this pose, but then we add some details, you know? So the first issue, I hit that stuff. I'm like, this kind of throws me off a little bit. Like, it's still good art, but, like, this is kind of odd. Then I read the second issue. There's just so many aspects about the book that are good on a different level that, I feel like that aspect of the art, like, maybe it's just, like, kind of a stylistic part of the book rather than being a flaw. But there's just so many things. Yeah. Like, his daughter is I guess, I don't know who the main character is. Like, in the current time version of the story, like, the dad is kind of the central character, even though it's presented through the eyes of the daughter, because he's the one driving the action. But then you hit the third issue, and we get something else going on, which I'll let you get to that. I don't want to steal your thunder here. But that second issue, it just, like, I hit a certain point. Sometimes there's a certain moment that you hit where certain things click, or it hits you a certain way that you're just like, this piece of art, whatever it is better than the sum of its parts. It's something special. There's something different about it. To give you an example with something else, movie The Royal Tenenbaums, which is my favorite movie, it was just a fine movie up until the suicide scene. That scene made it transcendent. And I feel like the second issue of Sword Daughter is where something clicked in it for me that made it transcendent.
I think it's the same with me. I think the second issue was it, and then the third issue built on it. And I don't want to give spoilers away, but remember, and I think it's the second issue, there's one panel near the middle of the book, and I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's definitely not fitting in. It didn't fit in the book.
Let me put it this way, because I read that. You actually pointed it out to me after I read it, and I went back. Or I think I was actually currently reading it, but I was past that point. So I went back and looked, and I knew which panel you were talking about, because my first read-through, I hit that panel. I was like, that's a place. Kept going. It didn't really have anything to do with what was going on necessarily, but you just were like, that's something that'll come back again.
Oh, yeah, and it does, big time, at the end of the third book. And like I said, I don't want to spoil it for anybody that hasn't read it. But it basically, I'm very curious about where he's going, what they're doing with this book, because this is set in a certain point, like in the late 900s AD, up in Scandinavian countries. There's some... What's the name of the band of bad guys? They're like the 40. I can't remember the name.
I don't.
Anyhow,
I'm awful.
There's
with names,
bad though. Guys kill her family, except for her and her dad survive. Her dad's in. He's not a coma because he seems like pretty much he gets woke up after 10 years of being in a catatonic state where he kind of functions, but he is just kind of there. And I guess people give him food and stuff. And it begins with an opening scene where the raid on the village happens. All the people die except for her. She survives somehow. And she finally gets tired of it after 10 years. She was very young when it happened, and she basically just smacks him upside the head with a rock and snaps him out of it. And actually, she goes to grab his sword, I think is what finally actually snaps him out of it. And then it's a revenge story is what it is. And then it jumps ahead in the third book to a setting where, how do I not spoil it too much? She is much older. I think it's like 10 years later, 5 years later, something like that. And she's being held, I guess you'd call it captive, or she's being retrained. And she's finally has enough of it, and things progress. That's a pretty good way of not spoiling it. Things happen at the end of that book. But the thing about it is, I was looking for when issue 4 comes out. And the only thing I've been able to find, and maybe some other people more knowledgeable can inform us, there's a hardcover of the first three issues coming out in, I think, November. But I have not seen any publication data for the next issue. And the way they leave it, it's not a complete story yet, because we don't know why she's in the position she is in issue 3 when she's older. And she... You know, you want to talk about a book that empowers young women. She definitely has a mind of her own and doesn't need anybody helping her, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I tweeted Brian Wood and asked, what the length of the series was intended to be. And he said that it's planned for 9 issues, and then at that point we'll see, you know, if it keeps going. And part of the reason I did that is, so it's $5 an issue, which I didn't realize at first, obviously, because I bought it on a Comixology sale for $1 an issue. And I loved it so much, I sent a message to my LCS and said, you know, are these attainable? He was able to order the first and the third one, but not the second one. So I said, well, just order me the third one, because I looked on eBay, and I could get the first and second one on eBay for a decent price. I didn't want to try to get just one issue because then you end up paying more for separate shipping and whatever. So I spent $10 on eBay for the first and second issue, thinking that I spent $2 more than cover price, essentially. I was like, that's fine.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
no, I only spent cover price because it's a $5 comic book. So that kind of caught me off guard a little bit. It's actually $5 an issue. Now, it is, I don't know if it's proper prestige format. I didn't look that close to see if they call it that or not. But it has that, like, firmer cards, like, kind of cover stock.
Nice,
And it's also, it's 28 pages rather than 22. So page count wise, if 22 is a normal comic book, that extra dollar, you're getting the page count for it. So I, you know, I don't know why they decided to go about it that way or whatever. Like, it still seems kind of odd to me to have a $5 comic book. But you're getting the page count, and quality wise, it's worth it. So, although I was caught off guard at first, like, I was like, that's fine. I'm going to get it. But I kind of wanted to
be... Was the second issue $5?
Yeah, every issue. First, second, third. That's how I knew it was $5. Okay. When I checked the new release list for my shop, it said sort of order number 3, because it had already been out, but he ordered it for me. So it was listed on there, sort of order number 3, $4.99. I was like, what?
Yeah, because I looked at my local comic shop and they didn't even have it. And I just did the digital, grabbed it on the sale, and that's definitely money well spent when it's on the sale. But the thing about that made me interested, and a lot of people probably know the name Brian Wood. Me, it's the first time I ever noticed it. I didn't know what he's done. I looked into some other titles he's done, and he did a book. He's done, I think he has a book like maybe similar to this called Northlanders or something, but I looked on Comixology Unlimited, and I'd got two books. One's called Rebels, and the other one is called Starve. I tried to read Rebels. It's set up in your area of the country, up in the Northeast. It's about the Revolutionary War, and set about 10 years before. And it's surprising that I didn't want to continue it. I might go. I'll probably go back to it and try to go through it. It'll probably get better. The art's fine. The story's fine. But it's a little bit too much of teaching of history rather than just telling the story, if you know what I mean. And I understand why. And, you know, and it's surprising to me that I didn't love it right off the bat, because I'm a big history nerd. My entire life I've been interested in history, and, you know, said it in a great writer telling a story like that. But another book that I grabbed is one called, and I didn't know if I were, it didn't really look interesting to me when I first glanced at it. It's called Starve. And let me pull it up here so I can get the artist name. It's, where is it? I had it already and I don't know where it is. There's another series he did start. I also started another one called The Massive that he's done. And Dave Stewart did colors on it, and I only read like the first issue, and it's really good. I'm going to continue it. It's kind of a post-apocalyptic setting where we've killed the Earth, then ice caps have melted, and people are kind of trying to figure out what's next. But this book, Starve, Brian Wood wrote it. Daniel Gizelje, he's a Croatian artist, I believe, does the pencils, and Dave Stewart colors it. And I've always been like a big fan of, like, I watch a lot of cooking shows, you know, and this is kind of taking from, it's not necessarily cooking shows, but this whole celebrity chef idea that started about last 15, 20 years or whatever. And, you know, I don't have many heroes, but one of the heroes I had was Anthony Bourdain. And because he just had a kind of an edgy take, and he went and did interesting things, had an interesting outlook, and was not scared to comment on things the way he felt about it. But the cool thing about this book is Brian Wood takes this whole idea of this celebrity chef with TV shows, and he sources that. So this is not a book. It's not Anthony Bourdain in any way. It's not Gordon Ramsay, who I don't like. Or any of these people. But he takes this idea, and it's this guy who is a chef, who starts up doing a show, becomes a celebrity called Starve, and it's just a competition show. He ends up falling out, just pretty much just drops off the map, abandons his family. He's a junkie, drugs, alcohol, whatever. And it follows him being lured back in to come back, do a certain number of episodes of the show because his wife's had him declared dead. And in order to regain that, and he senses regret for abandoning his child, for God's sakes. And it was just so compelling, the entire story. I blew through this book just because I wanted to see what the heck's happening. A lot of things going on in it. And the art is... the colors and the art match each other perfectly because it's not got a very broad color palette. So each page has maybe three or four different colors, and they do a really good job of that. It's just... I recommend it highly. You know, I like this better than I like Sword Daughter, to tell you the truth. And I'm looking forward to someday, hopefully they'll have a sale on Comixology where I can grab the next few volumes and see where this goes, because it gets nuts. I mean, it's not just like a cooking show. By the final, let's just say by the final issue of the first volume, I think it's five issues in that volume, it gets violent. Literally gets violent, where that's part of the show. And, yeah, Brian Wood. Are you familiar with anything else he's done other than these books that we're talking about?
I haven't read them heavily, but I've seen, like, The Massive I was familiar with. I honestly don't know if I've ever read a word of The Massive. I think I might have read the first issue at some point. But he's one of those guys, like, I've seen his name on a lot of different stuff that I've been like, someday. So Sword Daughter is the first thing that I've really gotten into. Starve definitely sounds interesting. There's something about Sword Daughter that I really like, so the other ones I'll check out. Before we started, I was dropping a few tweets, and one of them was, in the last month I've done a couple free trials, or, Hulu, I had a free month offer for Hulu, so I did that, I've done that in the past. I thought it was funny, because I did that, literally had Hulu for a month, did not use it once, so I just canceled it, and they even offered me another free month, and I didn't want it. When I signed up for Hulu, I was hoping it had a certain show that we wanted to watch, Young Sheldon, which you and I have discussed, but they don't have it, and I hate the interface on Hulu. I loathe it, so there's nothing that drew me on it, We have Netflix. If I want to watch a TV show, I'll watch something on Netflix. There's stuff on there I want to watch. I don't need another service, The other thing is Comixology Unlimited, which I signed up for a free trial of that because they had an offer. Not only was it for a free trial, which you can't go wrong there, but you also got a $5 gift card. So I got a $5 gift card for signing up for a free trial of Comixology Unlimited, which, by the way, was my third free trial of Comixology Unlimited since it launched. I didn't use it a bit because I got plenty of stuff to read. I have Marvel Unlimited, which is really kind of what I'm trying to focus on using. But the difference is with Comixology Unlimited, just poking around what's available, there's plenty of stuff I want to read. So once my Marvel Unlimited's up, I'm definitely going to hit up Comixology Unlimited. And, I mean, for $6 a month, you can't go wrong anyways. So it'll be a little while, but when that time comes, I'll be digging into some of the stuff that we've discussed.
One of the reasons I can't get through all the books that I have stacked up, partly that you sent, some I've just gathered up myself, is because I've just been diving into Comixology Unlimited. Man, it's just – I mean, I finally jumped on and – I've been planning on doing it. I've read almost every issue of the Marvel Star Wars since they relaunched it a couple of years ago. That's available on Comixology Unlimited, and I was uncertain about doing that, but I've loved it. I've read so many other things. It's just crazy. And like last week I read nothing, and this week I'm reading all kinds of stuff. I started Blood Feud by Cullen Bunn, which is pretty good. I've got The Damned by Cullen Bunn on cue to read. Soul actually wrote one of the Star Wars volumes. Jason Aaron wrote the Star Wars main title. And the first three or four issues, I was like, I really don't need this. But then it kind of evolves, and they start telling better stories. And I've enjoyed that. And then today I read, have you read Matt Kent's Black Badge yet?
No, but I want to.
Okay, I've got two issues. I'm putting them in the stack. I'm going to send them to you because I couldn't wait to not read them, and because I have them coming at a discount from another source. I don't dislike it, but it hasn't 100% grabbed me yet, which is weird. But there's a weird thing in here. No, I'm not going to do that because that's ruin things. It'll be a surprise for you when you do it. It's an interesting concept. Basically, it's kids that are scouts, and they are used as kind of an espionage or a black ops unit because they're kids and people kind of don't watch kids that much. And I finally read Borderland, the first issue, and I loved that, man.
Border Town?
Loved it. Border Town. I'm sorry. I loved it. There's so much in that first issue that there looks like they can expand on. It's just insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there really
is. And the art and the color just pop.
Yeah, Ramon's art, really, I really dig his art. But then Tamara Bond Villain's coloring is really good. Like, I haven't seen any of her other work, but like really? It was the kind of good that I'll keep an eye out for her name on stuff too, to see if it's something that might catch my attention, kind of like I've done with Matt Hollingsworth. Now that's just like a plus in the column of checking something out.
Really vibrant on that, so yeah, give thumbs up on that too. But that's pretty much my topic there. That book, Starve. It's an older book, but anybody that has Comixology Unlimited or is interested in it, I highly recommend it just as much as I recommend Sword Daughter.
Awesome. Yeah, Comixology. So my big sell on Comixology Unlimited for me, and this is also why I don't mind taking a good amount of time before I dive into it, is the original G.I. Joe, which is released on there as G.I. Joe Classics, I think. They have the whole collection of those trades on Unlimited now. The first time I looked, they had like three volumes. Now they have all of them. I didn't read G.I. Joe growing up, but I've been reading the IDW G.I. Joe, and I'm enjoying it. So I don't mind waiting because I kind of want to get through what I have already. And then going back to the original stuff, I won't be deluding myself too much. But anyhow.
Yeah. That's good stuff.
My last comment on comic books, based on something you said, so saying like Black Badge hasn't grabbed you yet. I remember when Royal City and Grass Kings were coming out. So Royal City is Jeff Lemire, Grass Kings is Matt Kent. But those are two writers that our smaller circle of friends tends to love, both writers. So, you know, people were excited about both of those. And Grass Kings, I was hearing a lot of from certain people that it wasn't doing it for them right off. They'd be talking about like what were the best books of the week, and like they would specifically make the comment that it was not Grass Kings with the first issue of Grass Kings. Grass Kings really grabbed me right away, and not because the story grabbed you yet, because it takes a little bit. Like the first issue is kind of like, here's an overlay, like, you know, the overlay of the land here. So there's nothing really to draw you in yet. But I guess I'm just really well suited to slow burns that are done well, you know, that are building up to something, letting the layers develop and not, expecting all the layers to be there right off the bat. I know you and I both loved, Wrath of the Eternal Warrior, and that's one that we argued about with people a lot when it was first coming out, because people had no patience for it. But with Grass Kings, I could see the structure of something really great. And now I think the ninth issue is the last one I read. And I'm waiting for a Comixology sale to be able to keep going from there. And I absolutely love that series. So, I don't, you know, Black Badge, we'll see. Like, not everything is necessarily going to be right for everybody, but I'm definitely looking forward to reading Black Badge just because it's Matt Kent. And Matt Kent, I have never gone wrong reading Matt Kent.
No, I'm not saying I don't like it. Yeah, but it didn't. And the thing is, like, it is a slow burn on this because he is setting something up. And I can't say a lot of because I don't want to ruin it for anybody that hasn't read it yet. There's a lot here that he can do with it. And the art is Tyler Jenkins. How do you say that?
Jenkins.
Yeah. I'm looking at him like, I don't know how to speak anymore. And the colors this time, he didn't do the colors. It's Hillary Jenkins. And I'm assuming that's his wife. I'm going on a limb. It's different than Grass Kings. The art, the lines and art is the same, but she colors things differently than him.
Interesting.
You know how his style is more of a watercolor.
Yeah.
It's good. It's really good. It's like, you know, somebody told me once, I think it was Martin, you don't ever judge a book till the third or fourth issue, because really the way they write stories now, it takes that much time to really build what you're going for. And it's interesting. I mean, these kids are in some precarious situations, and it's good. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
I read that and Border Town and another book called The Seeds, which by the art by David Aja and Ann Nocenti. And I'm not going to continue that, but it's not that it's not a good book. It's just not something I'm going to continue.
Yeah.
So,
all right. So that is I guess that's our comic book talk for now. I guess I'll go on to my next subject, which was intended to be my bigger topic of the night, but then I went on for a bit on the Wolverine stuff. But so I've been playing. I've mentioned this before, the BioShock games, but I finally started playing BioShock Infinite. That's a game that, when it was coming out 5 years ago, I really wanted it because I had played the first two BioShock games a while after they were released on the PS3, and BioShock Infinite was coming out, but then my PS3 died, and I didn't want to fix it. I didn't want to buy a new one. I just said, you know what? I mean, my son was quite young then, and I said, I don't need video games right now. So I got rid of it, and never got to play that game, which was one of the games I was most anticipating. Then they came out with the BioShock Collection that has all three games, and I bought that when it came out, which I think it was a year ago. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was about a year ago. And I played through the first one right away, didn't touch it for a long time, played through the second one, and then just took a brief pause and then started the third one. So BioShock Infinite is different than the first two. The first two take place in Rapture, which is like this city under the water. Very, very dark and dingy, and it's a pretty dead city. Like the people that are still living there, it has a very kind of like a post-apocalyptic kind of feel, but it's not post-apocalyptic. It's just, you know, this underwater world has gone to hell by this point. BioShock Infinite takes place in the sky. And it's similar in that it's these people that are like, we are separating off from, you know, like the main culture in the, you know, the United States, you know, in the first two BioShocks, they go under the water. This one, they secede from the Union, essentially. So it looks like kind of the start of the town in BioShock Infinite. And of course, I can't think of the name of it right now. It has a name. It was Rapture and the other two ones. It's like around the time of like the Civil War time. So, like, it's crazy. The stuff in this game is crazy. Like, when it first hits you, so like you the game. Oh my god, the game just starts off so good. You're in a rowboat. There's two people in the rowboat that are talking to each other, not talking to you. So you're kind of like, what the hell's going on? It's off the coast of Maine. So I already kind of like it. It's in 1912. So there you go. Time frame 1912. You get to this dock, you get off, you go into this lighthouse, you work your way through, you get shot into the sky to the city. Stuff's kind of coming together. You can kind of see, like, you have a job to do. You're going to recover this girl. It's weird, kind of cultish and stuff. You just kind of keep going through. The music. So, and this is kind of what I wanted to specifically talk about is the music in this. You start off getting hit with, and I may be remembering this a little bit wrong because this was like my first playthrough and I've kept pressing on. I haven't like gone back to re-experience it yet. But you hit, and I was looking this up on Wikipedia. You start hitting the music, and one of the first things in the licensed music that they have for this is a song, and I thought it was a Johnny Cash song, but I believe that if I'm remembering correctly looking at what I'm looking at here, Can the Circle Be Unbroken, and it's credited to the Carter family. So it probably had Johnny Cash on it, or could have. I'm pretty sure that...
I think it was originally by them, and then he married...
Yeah, he married June Carter, but I think that the song had Johnny Cash on it. Because I know Johnny Cash's voice quite well. And you keep going, and there are these different music influences, and it's very folky and stuff. What sold me, just like head over heels sold me on this. Like, you haven't even hit conflict in the game yet. You're just kind of like stumbling around. Nobody's trying to kill you or anything yet. And you're observing this town, and everything just seems so bright and cheery and happy. And you get to this point where you hear people singing, like the whole town singing together, this festival, and they're singing Goodnight Irene, which, like, in this case, they're singing it, but it's a Leadbelly song. I was just sold, because I knew who Leadbelly was just from... My wife actually brought Leadbelly to my attention years ago. But I was just sold at that point. But it just keeps getting even better. Like, there's all of that kind of stuff, and then as you go on, there's so much to the story, so, like, this is going to start to not make as much sense, but there's these rifts that's bringing you to different times, so you start getting these influences of music that is, like, 70s and 80s music. So, like, you'll be going on, and somebody will be singing a song in the style of the rest of the music in the game, but it's a song from, like, the 70s or the 80s that is completely not that style. Then you'll see these riffs, and you'll actually, like, get this music from the future essentially bleeding through. And I said, I haven't gotten to the end of the game, so I don't have a complete explanation for what's going on with this stuff yet. But this game just, in so many ways, has impressed me. Like, it's a fun game to play. It's like the other ones. It's a first-person shooter, essentially, but it's kind of like survival horror-ish. But not really like a survival horror, really, because survival horror usually like really limits your resources, and this definitely isn't as limited. But the just similar to the two games that preceded it, where it's dealing with a lot of kind of philosophical and social issues, this is dealing super heavily with racism. So the part where you get in the game where the conflict starts is you win this raffle. And they bring a young white man and black woman out on stage, and you have the baseball with the number that was the winning number. And what you win is the right to throw the first ball at these people. And essentially, like, I mean, they're setting up you, like, basically, they're going to stone these people for having an interracial relationship, but with baseballs instead of stones. It slaps you in the face with the issues of racism.
Yeah.
So this game is basically like if you took like kind of what we think of as like the kind of, you know, the what the negative connotations of the Confederate flag, and just like everything as negative as you can take it, and then shoot it into the air and put this like really like bright and beautiful surface over it all. And then as you keep going, like, man, oh my goodness, does it get more and more like just exposing this racism. It's just crazy. Like I'm blown away by the game and the commentary that the game is making while being something that is just like so amazing on so many different levels.
That sounds good, man. Yeah, you recommended the other night I check out the – you said you were listening to the playlist. You said, do you have Spotify? Check this out. I mean, it's got at least 5 songs by Johnny Cash. And I'm looking through it. I was listening through it earlier today some more, and it's like there's – Black Rebel Motorcycle Club's on here, Lincoln Durham. I know these people, The Heavy. There's William Elliott Whitmore. Like I said, there's at least 5 Johnny Cash's – I mean, a couple of his my favorites. God's Gonna Cut You Down from his, I think it's his last album, Hurts on there, The End. And it's like, it's a playlist that was built for me listening to the early on because it's kind of got that bluesy Americana, just roots kind of music, kind of gritty. And then a little bit longer down near the end, where was it? I just saw it. You're talking about the 70s. Oh, it's got Billy Ray Cyrus on it. I don't know about that being on there. But I can't see it now. It's something like Stevie Nicks or Fleetwood Mac being on there. Daddy Sang Bass by Johnny Cash, another by Lincoln Durham. Good soundtrack, just for nothing else. I mean, I'd like to check the game out someday, but for nothing else, the fact they put these, if and these are actual songs that they play on.
At least some of them. I think apparently that this playlist, because it was created by somebody. I mean, I haven't tried to like dig in deeper and like get any more details on it.
Okay.
There's a lot of music on there, so I think that it may be kind of like also music in the same vein. So it's not necessarily that all of it is in the game.
Gotcha.
On Wikipedia, I found a little bit more information of stuff that's specifically on the game. I mean, there is an original score for the game also, but then they release a licensed soundtrack, which isn't on Spotify, which is where I found that playlist that was released. The soundtrack was released in 2013. So these are the songs that are on the original Songs Uncovered, which was the licensed soundtrack for the game. Can the Circle Be Unbroken by the Carter Family? Give Me That Old Time Religion, Jane Russell, Connie Haynes, Rhonda Fleming. It All Depends on You, Ruth Etting. Ain't She Sweet, Jimmy Lunceford. Goodnight Irene, Lead Belly. Your Grand Old Flag, Billy Murray. Making Whoopee, Eddie Cantor. After You're Gone, Ruth Etting. I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, The Mary Max. The Clouds Will Soon Roll By, Ambrose and His Orchestra. Liza, All the Clouds Will Roll Away, Al Jolson. Behind the Clouds, Joe Lawson and His Orchestra. And then other licensed music in the game, Old Time Religion, St. James Infirmary Blues, Button Up Your Overcoat, Goodnight Irene, Just a Closer Walk with Thee, Dewey Day, Shine on Harvest Moon, Me and My Shadow, I'm Wild About That Thing, Wild Prairie Rose, Ain't She Sweet, Shake Sugary, Ain't We Got Fun, The Bonnie Blue Flag, Requiem in D Minor, K626, more classic music. I'm not gonna read all these classic music names.
This is a lot of old American classic music. Is what it sounds just like.
Give me a moment here. I'm not done yet. Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Blah blah blah. Okay, let me skip some of these. Okay, here's where it gets interesting. Anachronistic covers of modern songs. So songs After You've Gone.
Okay.
God Only Knows. Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Tainted Love, Fortunate Son, Shiny Happy People, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. And these are all done in very different musical style that fits in with the vein of the music in the city that you're playing in. It's just, it's so different. Like going through a game and all of a sudden you hear somebody A barbershop. This was one that stood out to me. The barbershop quartet singing "God Only Knows." It was just like, oh man, it's just amazing. Like, really, the music and soundtrack in this game is absolutely amazing and very different.
That's very cool. That's like another. I mean, that just adds to it. It doesn't have to. They didn't have to do that, but that just adds another level of texture to the game for you, right? Kind of like a good colorist adds to the art and words. The music, being able to have that awesome music involved, that just really expands your experience.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned in Sword Daughter how there was something about the second issue that just made it transcendent, or in the Royal Tenenbaums, that scene, the suicide scene, made it transcendent. Hitting certain spots with the music in this is what did that. And honestly, it didn't even take long. Hearing the town singing together, "Goodnight, Irene," is what did it. But then you hit other points in it that just took it even further, like the barbershop quartet singing "God Only Knows." Some of the other ones that are even a little more like 70s or 80s-ish, and then hearing them pop in, but in that different... Oh, it really, like... You thought it was already, like, just this transcendent thing, and then they did something that, like, just even went further than you expected, you know? It's absolutely blown me away.
Wow. I don't even play many games, and now you made me want to check this out someday. Maybe I will.
Yeah, and I've been playing it on easy, too. One thing that I've decided... Like, I can play more difficult games. Normally I would always play games just on the normal setting, and then, you know, after I play through that way, if I want more of a challenge, bump it up. I ain't got time for challenges. I'm having a ball playing it on easy. Yeah. I have not been afraid of dying once in this game. Well, there was one time I actually got pretty darn close to it because I just wasn't paying attention. I was being real sloppy with it. But I have no problem with just being able to go through and just rip the bad guys to shreds. Because it's not just about the gameplay. It's about just the experience. You know, the story, the gameplay, it's just been... I absolutely love this game. Like, we'll see how, like, when I play it again. Because the first two Bioshocks I played twice. So this may be... It's the shiny new thing that this is the first time I'm experiencing it. But I feel like this is probably beating the other two for my favorite in the series. And... These might be my favorite games of all time. Yeah, really? I mean, there's a few that would definitely be competing with it. Impressive. And I'd have to, like, it may be depending on the perspective you look at, because I think that the Legend of Zelda game from the Super Nintendo, that's probably my favorite game of all time. But, you know, these are newer and different, so I don't know. But anyways... What do you got next?
Make it short and sweet because we're running a little long. We both love The Office. We've talked about this before. If you want to know what happened to Jim after The Office ended, he didn't move to Austin. He ended up joining the Army, and then he started working for the CIA and changed his name to Jack Ryan. We watched, my wife and I, a couple of weeks ago, the Amazon's Jack Ryan, Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan series was out. And I loved it. We devoured it. It was so good. They updated the character perfectly. And you know, you can't help not think, well, that's Jim. But, you know, he's a little edgier. He's tougher. He's a little bit tougher guy than he was in The Office. He's got some skills, let's just say. I highly recommend it. The way they touched on the topic of terrorism, it wasn't just your normal take on it. They gave humanity to everybody on the show. I mean, even the bad guys, to a certain point, you do feel like a certain level of, I can kind of identify with this person, and then, oops, now I don't identify with that person anymore, which I think is pretty real world. It's a good show, and it's not that many episodes, I don't think. I think it's only 8. But it is really good. So that's my quick take on that. I recommend that highly. And anybody, the last episode we were together, I talked about fantasy football, how I was making people cry. Well, I've just been crying since. So my apologies. Hopefully I'll turn it around this week. So we'll see.
it's been an interesting year so far. We've gone pretty long, so we'll just kind of wrap it up. I'll just throw out there, I mentioned this to you, but a couple of podcasts I really enjoy around football. One is the first podcast I ever listened to. I've been listening to for, I think this is their 11th season, but the ESPN Fantasy Focus Football podcast. It's just an entertaining one to listen to. Another one I haven't listened to yet, but I've listened to this person on podcast, is Mina Kimes, who is a writer for ESPN. She just started her own podcast called Bootleg with Mina Kimes. I've heard her on other podcasts. She's also a great follow on Twitter. It's MinaKimes. I just really like her style and take on stuff. So I haven't listened to her podcast yet, but like I said, I've heard her on others, and I don't doubt that it's going to be good. So just in the vein of us talking about football, I want to throw those out there. But now I believe we can wrap it up. So you can find me on Twitter at Who's Paul. You can find the show on Twitter at Occasionally STW. You find Sparky on Twitter at MD Sparkman. You go to NerdyLegion.com to find all the rest of the wonderful Nerdy Legion podcasts, including 2BT that Sparky does with his cousins. And I also mentioned Comic Talk Today with Martin. Plenty of other podcasts on there. We got quite a few. And we will call it a night. So have a good night.
Yes. Have a good night.
Zoom like that. We out. We out. We out. We out.